what is it good for?
You're the In Context studio tonight, huh?
That's we're in the In Context studio, and my name's Ken McDermott Rowe. The name of the program is In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show, and I'm here with my co-host, Gus Cantavero.
Good evening.
And we are going to talk about some issues that relate to war tonight. In the most recent issue of the Rock Creek Free Press, Webster Tarpley wrote that the situation in the world today is very perhaps similar to the way that the world looked on the eve of World War I in 1914. And as we look at the wars in Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq, and we look at the potential disintegration of Pakistan, Mr. Tarpley, we want to get into the wars, and we want to take your phone call, so we'll be giving out the number in a few minutes. And to give us an interesting perspective on the wars that are going on around the world, we're very happy to have with us today March McDermott Rowe, who's my son, who's joining us as our military affairs commentator. And he just posted a very interesting article on the In Context Report blog called One Bomb, No America. March, I'd like to introduce you to the In Context office audience. And could you talk to us about your article and specifically what are EMPs?
Well, good evening, everyone. EMPs, basically, it's an electromagnetic pulse. It's a sudden burst of electricity at incredibly high volume, incredibly high voltage. And what my article specifically talks about is a bomb based on that. This is technology developed during the Cold War, but only recently has decided to become weaponized.
It's actually that old?
It has. Actually, it was during the darkest days of the Cold War. EMP technology was dabbled a little bit because one of the effects of a nuclear bomb detonation is a large electromagnetic pulse is sent out and it wipes out electricity.
Mm.
So the military was working on hardening its defenses so that, let's say, a nuclear bomb were to go off and we wouldn't lose communication.
Okay.
It wasn't considered an overall threat.
I mean, this is something that I've seen in, you know, science fiction movies or, you know, war dramas or, you know, a thing on shows on NBC or something for years. You know, and most of the time you'd see something like that and be like, oh, that's just purely fiction.
It was the premise of Dark Angel, a very interesting series that was on TV. It takes place in Seattle in the aftermath, I believe, of an EMP attack. And American civilization is knocked back like 100 years. Oh. People are living the subsistence lifestyle. It spawned a police state. And basically, it was the aftermath of, as I understand, the EMP attack.
And segueing into your article, just to finish up the thought, of a fiction, most of the time what we read about in these like science journals or we see in science fiction, you think that that's purely just imagination. It's probably 90% true. It just isn't in the popular realm of information yet.
It seems like, because you look at the idea, you know, how could a country have the ability to wipe out, I mean, everything we know, everything that's electronic, because our life functions so much on it. It's almost bizarre to think about, but it's something the Chinese invested very heavily in after the first Gulf War.
Okay.
They saw our stealth technology, and that was something that really frightened them. It was when we first unveiled the B-2 bomber, Nighthawk stealth fighter, and we had the ability to knock out. The Iraqis were equipped, surprisingly, with some of the latest of Chinese-made military technology, and we blew right through that. We destroyed the command and control centers, the communications, so the Chinese realized, well, we really got to play catch-up to the Yankees. And that's when they began investing in EMP technology, along with the help of the Russians, who, under the administration of Vladimir Putin, which came considerably after the Gulf War, has decided that it wanted to get back in the imperial game, if you will. It wanted to knock the American giant down. And the EMP is the ultimate weapon of warfare.
So the idea is you blow off a nuclear missile pretty high in the atmosphere, and then it disables all kinds of electronic equipment in the surface of the Earth.
Exactly. It's a nuclear missile of sorts. Not exactly. But it uses a nuclear explosion, at least as we understand it. And detonating the upper atmosphere, it sends down an intense electromagnetic pulse. And to give you an idea of how extensive the damage is, everything that runs on electricity, from your cell phone to your car battery to your laptop to your radio, I mean, everything you can imagine, overloads.
Taking that another step, not just your car, most cars are run by onboard computers. So now if you have a car that's later than 1990, most likely it's run by an onboard computer that controls the fuel injection, the air intake. I mean, it just doesn't end there.
All of that would be fine. And not to mention, the first step of every major modern war, and this really dates back to the Israeli 67 war, the Six-Day War,
mm-hmm.
when Israel launched a preemptive strike on Egypt and Syria and destroyed the Arab air forces and communications. The first principle of every major war is to destroy an enemy's air power, communications, and command and control. And the EMP does that because none, virtually none, of our command and control or our military hardware is hardened against this.
So not just the average person, he'd lose his telephone, but your command and control system for your military, your probably utility companies would be out.
Emergency response.
Precisely.
Everybody would be out.
In fact, according to our armchair general, which had a phenomenal mm-hmm. article on the Chinese EMP capabilities, it said, most of the United States, including our emergency services, particularly our emergency services, would not have any idea what had happened
right.
for days. It's not even months.
You made the point of saying that the only time people would know that they are being invaded are when they see Chinese troops marching down their street.
Precisely. when you think about it, how much do we in the olden days, you used to, you had a courier who came through, you had the newspaper boy who delivered the newspaper from a printing press. Everybody finds out everything through the telephone, through the internet, through television. So if you were to take all of that out of the equation, honestly, we probably wouldn't have a clue until we saw some guys in red berets, walking down the street. And another theory, actually, that was posed by Armchair General was the level of lawlessness that would ensue.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, the Chinese might be welcomed in even as liberators because they'd be bringing law and order, tragic as it is.
It would be almost a humane type way of waging war because you wouldn't have to level the American cities. You would just disable the communication system.
The only response, it would be more of a civilian response with, will we have 40 million gun owners in this country?
Right.
It would be more
Second
of a...
Second Amendment would be our... Would it be our
that would be our defense.
Line of defense.
Yeah.
And now we're...
Without command and control, without communications, I mean, there'd be no coordination. I mean, one of the ways the Iraqi insurgency, or particularly the Afghan insurgency, have always been successful, they had extensive communications networks. Without that, I mean, you can't be... You got a whole lot of folks who own guns, but if they can't coordinate between each other,
right.
then the Chinese can destroy them piecemeal.
Now, we're talking about specifically about China, but Russia is also making advances in its military technology.
Yes, China and Russia move hand in hand. It's very naive to think that the Cold War ended because the Soviet Union collapsed. That was a hiatus. Yeltsin went, and we got Vladimir Putin and Medvedev, who are old communists themselves. So really, all this was a hiatus. And China and Russia are natural allies because individually, really, they lack the technological and military capability to take on the United States, but with their combined strength, I mean...
And they do have that, it was a Shanghai Cooperation Organization, I believe it's called.
Precisely. Back in, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 2005, China and Russia signed a mutual defense agreement, which allowed them to exchange military technologies. In fact, the new Chinese stealth bomber, which was recently unveiled, which many people don't know about, but you can look it up on YouTube.
And the links are in your article on our website, incontextreport.com.
They are. And the bomber actually, as I believe cited in one of the videos, was revealed during a visit by Defense Secretary Robert Gates to China. And this was developed in conjunction with a Russian effort to develop the stealth fighter because the Russians already have a stealth fighter.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really the first, what you consider the fourth generation aircraft.
Now, we have stealth bombers, but we don't have stealth fighters, do we?
We do. I mean, we have the Nighthawk, which is a stealth fighter to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
This really is a very futuristic stealth fighter because it possesses all the capabilities of a fighter and a bomber, which it has the capability of delivering a very heavy payload, as well as being a strike aircraft. It can drop a large amount of munitions.
So that's like what our like F-21, what is that? Which is one like from Top Gun that actually could carry like a heavy bomb, but it's also a high-speed fighter?
Oh, the F-14 Tomcat.
The 14, okay. Is that similar to that?
It's actually, interestingly enough, the design was taken from various American aircraft,
yeah.
Coincidentally. But it's a very, very similar capability.
Okay.
But being stealth, it can slip through radar.
Right, right.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport. We're talking about new developments in military technology, particularly the EMP weapon, the stealth fighter that's been developed by China. And our phone number to join the conversation is 203 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And Mark, you also mentioned in your article the missile that was apparently launched from a submarine off the coast of Los Angeles. Could you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, the one that the Defense Department tried to tell
us. This would be last November 8th, yeah.
Yep, the one that the Defense Department tried to tell us was a jet stream. Now, folks, you can go and look on YouTube for yourselves. It's obvious this is not a jet stream. Otherwise, if it was a jet stream, there'd be reports of missiles flying all across the country. It's very clearly a missile launched from the coast. And the fact that the Navy responded with an aircraft carrier to a disabled
Carnival cruise ship, Carnival Splendor.
Exactly. Really, if something like that, if a Carnival cruise ship were to disable, the Coast Guard would go out and say, but they send out a Navy aircraft carrier to the same site that this missile was launched from. And if we were doing a test, we would have said, oh, it was a test. But the fact that it took the Defense Department 12 hours to respond, to make a statement, I mean, they denied it emphatically, because it's a very scary thought. During the Cold War, you would never thought of the Soviets launching a missile over the continental United States. But it makes you realize how vulnerable we are and something very humiliating to admit.
This was a statement by the Chinese that they could get close to the United States and shoot off a missile from a sub, and there's nothing we could do about it.
Exactly. One thing we've let go tremendously is our submarine nets, our naval warfare capabilities, because we really never, at the end of the Cold War, we never planned to wage another major war against a major superpower. We thought it's a very short-term view, but we thought, well, we're the dominant power. Why worry about it?
And, in fact, we are engaged and have been for many years now in what you might call colonial counterinsurgency wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now it looks like we're getting into one in Libya, which really brings us to the strategic situation which makes a conflict with China a possible, and that is that we have divided the world essentially into two camps, it seems, the United States and its allies in NATO in attempting to gain hegemony over the world's oil resources, and opposed to us is now lining up this combination of Russia, China, and Iran. And as we see the conflict get more intense, in particular now we see in Pakistan, it seems like the Chinese are moving closer to a direct confrontation. And I mentioned Pakistan because of the recent developments, Augusta, in the last, especially during May with the attack on Pakistani soil without the Pakistan government's permission and this alleged assassination of bin Laden. And then following on that heels, the visit of Pakistan, the Pakistani leader to China.
Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting is there was a major incident that occurred recently. I believe it was in, I want to say Karachi, but I'm not 100% on that. But it was an assault on a Pakistani naval base.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't any small naval base. This was one of their foremost naval bases.
Well, that was about a week and a half after the bin Laden supposed charade.
Exactly. Now, four insurgents, supposedly, of Eastern European descent, it appears, or European descent in general is what the BBC cited, stormed this base. Killed the guards with, you know, tapped in the back of the head, and blew up several aircraft, then proceeded...
So British Special Forces, in other words.
These are four guys.
It's
like a Rambo here.
If the Taliban did this on a regular basis, we would be having that thing.
Right.
It's absurd. But then they go in, they repel Pakistan naval commandos. Now, these guys are no joke. They're trained by us. And they repel the Pakistan naval commandos. Then they storm the headquarters. And they take hostage, according to the first article I read. It didn't appear in any subsequent articles.
Mm-hmm.
On the BBC, it said that they took Chinese military advisors hostage.
Now, very specific targets who they knew were there.
Exactly.
Somebody
obviously knew.
Okay.
Chinese had military advisors there.
Uh-huh.
Well, now the Pakistani...
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
The Pakistani press has reported an alliance between the Mossad and the Indian CIA... RIW, I think it's called, operating under the leadership of the American CIA to form terrorist groups to conduct terrorism within Pakistan. Now, India, of course, is very strongly behind this because the Indians would love to see Pakistan broken up.
Oh, the Indians are very threatened by Pakistan, in part because they view Pakistan as a source of instability.
Sure.
And they view Pakistan as a potential rival in the region. I mean, India does have regional aspirations. You know, I mean, we think because the rest of the fighting is taking place in, you know, the Middle East. We forget that in countries like India were at one point in time superpowers in the region. And just like Persia, just like Iran wants to be a superpower in the region again, so does India. And it benefits Israel very well to see a destabilized Pakistan, because in turn Pakistan supplies many guns and arms to Hamas and to Fatah in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, respectively.
Mm-hmm. So it all ties together. And if you'd like to join this conversation, please give us a call at In Context at area code 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to join our conversation.
Now, let's shift gears a little bit to talk about what's going on in Libya. I have a few articles here. One from a Russian source. It's from AP via the Yahoo News. And the headline is, Russia, NATO is one step from a land war in Libya. And this is just published today. And Russian Deputy Prime Minister Sergei Ivanov says NATO is one step from sending troops into Libya in a bid to help rebels remove Muammar Gaddafi from power. And again, this is something that we were promised wasn't going to happen. We were promised that there wasn't going to be a land invasion. And I have another article here that says NATO helicopter attacks tantamount to ground operation. And that's also from a Russian source, the Russian foreign minister. Now, why is Russia so concerned with what's going on?
I think because they see it as a power play by the U.S. and by NATO to kind of flex its military muscle in the region. Russia and China, interestingly enough, both had oil deals, particularly China had very important oil contracts with Libya, which Libya only supplies, I believe it's 2% of the world's oil. But to China, that's very significant, and to Russia, it's very significant, because Russia has a lot of oil, but it's deep in Siberia, and it's very expensive to drill there.
Okay.
So to them, and Libya is a valuable ally. Equally, Sudan, its Libya's neighbor, has also been an ally of the Chinese and the Russians.
Africa is really becoming a prime battleground in this.
It's a hotbed
between China, Russia, and U.S., NATO on the other side. The Chinese, I understand, are investing heavily and lending lots of money to African governments in order to forge strong economic alliances. And of course, they're getting oil from the Sudan as well.
Interestingly, though, China, I think, has changed their foreign policy methods, though, because instead of taking their cues from the American and British foreign intervention methods, where they supply an opposition with arms and then they encourage them to fight it out until everyone's dead, and then we just roll in and take over.
Yes,
China has actually built a lot of production and industry and helped people to get fresh water and build schools and things like that, where they could actually fend for themselves in a way. So it's almost like they're building up strong allies rather than conquering, which really is a more productive way to do things.
Seems like a no-brainer, but something we haven't discovered yet.
It's almost the way the Chinese have historically viewed the outside world. Because to them, everything outside is the Asiatic, where, the Western barbarians, people really you could do business with, but they weren't worth wasting your time conquering. So as a result, it was much more of they viewed the outside world in terms of business relationship. We'll give you guns, we'll buy your oil, we'll have a relatively fair.
But they don't care if people speak Chinese or adopt the Chinese economic system or social system. It's not their problem.
They don't care. I mean, for the United States and for NATO in particular, we want to see a quote unquote Western style democracy and this and that. The Chinese don't care if you're a fascist, if you're a communist, if you're a Democrat, if you're a dictator. As long as they can do business with you,
and they do need oil. That is,
their need for natural resources could be overriding any nationalistic interest. Whether they want to spread communism or not could be overriding their need for natural resources. Like America, we have a lot of resources. We just rather not use them because it's dirty. So we'll just import yours and have you, build oil wells in your kids' backyards and things like that. Obviously, when it happens here, we suppress the information. Like I just saw Gasland last week and talking about the oil, natural gas fracking. But that takes place in most of our farmlands where there just aren't a lot of people and they don't have the resources to bring it to a national attention. But that kind of thing just doesn't happen in New York City or in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or San Francisco, because people have power and influence.
And Bobby Kennedy, I believe, just came out with a film on the blowing off these mountaintops in West Virginia to get coal.
Oh.
And again, there are any powerful people there to oppose it? There is not a politician in the state that will oppose it because they're all on the take of the coal companies.
Right. Well,
the people are overwhelmingly opposed to
it. Exactly. Now, one of the other things I wanted to mention, because this one has sort of a domino effect, Ty, we were talking before the show, and you had told me back in 2003 there was a deal with the United Nations, negotiated by the United States and others to get Libya to hand over their materials that they were using to pursue nuclear development. Is that true? Is that correct? Did I sum that up right?
Oh, yes, precisely.
Okay.
We pretty much told Gaddafi, if you don't turn over your nuclear materials, we will invade Libya like we just did Iraq.
Right.
And Gaddafi opened his doors wholeheartedly to the United States and to the IAEA.
Right.
So he was getting foreign deals with American oil companies.
And something that just came out May 31st, this is just a week and a half ago, the headline here is Goldman Sachs lost 98% of Libya's $1.3 billion sovereign wealth fund investment. Now, one of the important key points that we've talked about before is the fact that Libya has a state-run bank,
right,
which is something that we're advocates for.
Yeah.
We're state-run banks.
With Gus and I on this
yeah.
show. Yeah, we've had Ellen Brown on, who's the chief promoter of state publicly owned banks in the United States.
Precisely. And, they also have a state-run oil company where they reinvest a lot of the profits from oil, and they reinvest in the state so that they can have public works projects. They can have things like free education. Yeah, Cynthia McKinney, former representative Cynthia McKinney, and presidential candidate, has been in Libya now for, I don't know if she's still there, but she was there for at least a week and a half. And I think she was coming back and then going back to Libya for another 2 weeks. And she's got a lot of guts. She goes to the place where the bombs fall. And most people just don't have the courage to do that, especially since she's sort of a marked woman.
Yes.
You know, she to go to a dangerous place, to make yourself a target like that.
She's the kind of person, agree with her or not, she's the kind of
you
person.
You have to admire.
You have to admire. We should have people like that in Congress.
Exactly.
She was purged from Congress. Right?
And she said in an interview that they have free education up through the graduate level. You can get a master's degree for free.
The thing we feel about Gaddafi, and he probably is a brutal person, but he is a nationalist, and he has done a lot.
He loves his country.
And he has also helped sub-Saharan Africa. I understand he's used a lot of his oil money to found a financial institution to help finance projects of development. In the
It could be that he's a thug, that he is probably a little bit overambitious with his methods sometimes. Maybe he doesn't tolerate people with dissenting opinions. But you can't argue with the fact that he loves his country.
So where do the opposition, these people in Benghazi?
Well, hang on a second. Before you get into that, because that's a different tangent, I just want to mention really quick the fact that Goldman Sachs and the domino effect here with 2003 to 2004, the very next year, only several months later, the embargo was lifted on trade of businesses doing business with Gaddafi in Libya and Libyan companies. And that just seems to me like it's just too coincidental. I would love to see the terms of those papers, but we won't see that for another 20 years until it's declassified.
Right.
But, the fact that that embargo was lifted only a year later just seems too coincidental for me. And on top of that, I really believe that I see a setup here because in that same year, Goldman Sachs goes in there, starts investing with Libya. Libya gives them hundreds of millions of their dollars. Eventually, it leads to a $1.3 billion investment with Goldman Sachs, who we all know helped to trigger the financial crisis, where they profited on the way down and then they got bailed out, or they profited on the way up and then profited on the way down after the collapse. So they take all this money, they lose it all, they lose 98% of it, and then they offer as a compensation to Libya their preferred stock, which then loses all of its value. And as we know, Warren Buffett invested a lot into them in the financial collapse. And, that was to try to get people to get confidence back and, reinvest. And then they regain it all. But that's only after Libya loses all of this money.
So they needed a good broker. not Goldman Sachs.
And it just goes to show that I think they were setting Libya up as a target so that they could make them ripe for invasion.
Do you think that we turned on them? We had a change of heart recently? Or do you think that we've been angling to get a hold of Libya for a long time, and for some reason the time is in right now?
I think the revolution in the Arab world presented us with an opportunity, and I think we felt Gaddafi was slipping the leash. I mean, let's face it, Pakistan certainly slipping the leash. I mean, everybody, the rat's deserting the ship. All our former toadies are realizing that we can't protect
them
anymore.
That's right.
So
they're
going to the Chinese, they're going to the Russians for security because they know we are what keep their regimes in power.
Well, this is a quote from May 17th visit of the president of Pakistan to China. Quote, We are proud to have China as our best and most trusted friend.
Well, and I mean, let's face it, the Pakistani government's teetering on the brink of collapse. They're massively unpopular. I mean, I once spoke to a Pakistani...
The Pakistani government is unpopular?
Oh, yeah. I once spoke to a Pakistani friend of mine and said, why do so many Pakistanis seem to support the Taliban? And she simply said to me, she said, look, if she was in a Lahore, which is a major city, she said, I'm running water and electricity for 6 hours out of a whole day.
Wow.
She said, and the Taliban come in and they say, we'll give you running water and electricity. So that's all...
For 12 hours.
For 12 hours. All that people care about. And so the regime knows all that will keep them in power is a strong military.
And they're not real. They realize that the United States is in alliance with Israel, and the average Pakistani, I'm sure, is not really thrilled with the idea of helping the United States in its war in Afghanistan.
Of course not, but I think more importantly, they see from our drone attacks and from our operations.
Well, yes.
To stop the Taliban, they know we cannot prevent the collapse of their regime. I mean, fundamentally, that's what the government's concerned about. Morality and everything aside, their biggest issue is how can we stay in power? And they know China could, if they needed to, submit a million men to Pakistan to keep the regime in power. We can't do that.
If you'd like to join the conversation again, we're at 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. We're on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, streaming at WPKN.org. You know, there's a very good article in Global Research, which is a free online newsletter coming out of Montreal, Canada, and a recent article called about U.S. policy in Pakistan by Andrew Gavin Marshall. He talks about how for many years we've seen the possibility of the United States intelligence structure has seen the possibility that Pakistan will become a failed state. And it even seems that we are anticipating that Pakistan might collapse into three separate entities, leaving only what we think of now as Pakistan as a rump state of Punjabis, with many of them going into a new Pashtun kingdom, which would be partly Pakistani, partly Afghanistan, and the rest going into a kind of a southern kingdom, which might also carve out part of Iran, which would be composed of the Sindh and the Baluch tribesmen. So would become the three countries, which would really fit in with the overall U.S. policy, it seems, of balkanizing countries in order to control regions, which we saw in Yugoslavia.
Of course, it's a very simple principle of divide and conquer. I mean, we've done it so many times. I mean, the fact that we've helped sponsor the Chechen rebels against the Russians, you know, continue to break up Russia as much further as we can. It's a very common.
That's not generally well known in the United States that we are fomenting the Chechen resistance to Russian rule.
I think at this point we backed down from it quite a bit, in part because the Chechens have become so closely tied to the forces that are fighting us. I mean, many Chechens have been found to be fighting in Afghanistan, particularly Afghanistan, fighting in Iraq and Palestine. But I read an interesting article in the Army Times of all places. Where an unidentified intelligence officer said they intercepted Taliban radio transmissions during radio chatter during a battle. He spoke neither Russian nor Chechen, but he said he heard it was distinctly either Chechen or Russian, which, I mean, tells you one of two things. That either...
Is that a Chechen or a Russian?
Exactly. Either the Russians are directly in Afghanistan aiding our enemies, or the Chechens have slipped the leash, neither of which is good.
Well, so far, it seems like both the Russians and the Chinese want to avoid direct confrontation with us, that the wars are being fought through surrogates. Now, are the Chinese and the Russians sufficiently confident that they can push back against us to have a direct confrontation anytime soon? Or do you think the situation of surrogate fighting is going to go on for years?
Or do they even have to have a direct confrontation with us because we'll just financially collapse and be unable to actually pay to fight them?
That's right. And as Paul Kennedy said in his great book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, military defeat follows economic decline.
Mm-hmm.
It merely ratifies the fact that you're no longer numero uno.
Well, I think one thing, I mean, if anything, I see this pattern in history that no empire has very rarely, I mean, it has happened, but very rarely have empires rescinded their control to another empire, to a rival, without significant amount of bloodshed. I mean, the Spanish, and their economy was in ruins, fought us tooth and nail for the Philippines and even Cuba and Puerto Rico. I think, though, the Russians, to be honest, and the Chinese both know that the United States is an incredibly resilient animal. I mean, we've bounced back from economic collapse, we've bounced back from civil war, and we've only become stronger afterwards. I think they want to knock us down and make a statement by knocking us off our pedestal, by completely – and the Chinese have a total war philosophy. You completely destroy and obliterate your enemy, and Sun Tzu's art of war.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a military clash, unless we were to give up our –
Well, that's such a scary scenario.
I think it's almost inevitable. I mean, like World War I or World War II looming on the horizon – it seems like every 100 years or so we have a major war like this.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. Of course, the perspective that I have is that we should return to a foreign policy of Washington and Jefferson, a Republican foreign policy, not an interventionist foreign policy, which has dominated American foreign policy since World War II, so that we won't have these confrontations. We should just treat other nations with mutual respect and close our 700 foreign military bases and have a military establishment to defend the United States of America. We'd save a heck of a lot of money, and I think we tremendously cut down the risk of this conflict.
And we make a lot more friends, too.
We make a lot more friends. That's the way I think we should be going, but I don't see anybody except for Ron Paul in the Republican Party and Dennis Kucinich in the Democratic Party. We've got a Democratic president, and he's expanded the war beyond probably the wildest dreams of George Bush Jr.
Of course, and his administration has done nothing but to provoke China. I mean, Hillary Clinton once said one of the most obnoxious things I've ever heard any politician say. She said that China should not try to, and I'm paraphrasing here, try to stifle the democratic movements because it is only a fool's errand, which is in essence saying we are going to topple the Chinese government. I mean, it's tantamount to that. And the Chinese responded by saying any threat to the Chinese regime is a fool's errand. I mean, it's just rattling the saber with – it's like the little kid in the yard rattling the saber with, the football jock. It's a terrible idea. But that shows you how out of touch both the Democrats and Republicans are. Nobody considers it a possibility. That's what people say.
Well, Hillary has to talk big in the press, though, because the American public still has to have confidence in their government to get the job done when the chips are down,
Very true.
I mean, not that I don't think Hillary Clinton is not out of touch. I definitely am no fan.
I just wonder what really goes on inside her brain, because she went over there to Pakistan.
It's just window dressing.
May the 27th, and she had the meeting with the leaders of Pakistan, and the reports indicated that the meetings did not appear to go well. They're very, very, very tense. They had one public session. And it said that the head of Pakistan.
That's putting it lightly, isn't it?
They were from the press, and whatever he said they said it was inaudible. It doesn't sound like it was any kind of.
I'm sure that there was some slamming of fists on tables and throwing of glasses or something.
And then apparently Pakistan officials leaked the name of the CIA, U.S. CIA station chief.
So who said that?
That was a Pakistani leaked the name of our CIA station chief. And then asked the Pentagon to withdraw some of its military advisors. And so there may actually even be some clashes with them.
I mean, I think at this stage, every aspect of the American leadership and even the American public is in denial about how badly our foreign policy is going.
Well, I mean, I think it connects to your article on the EMP bomb, because it shows that we're completely unprepared for an attack like that. And even just the fact that the Chinese launched the missile 200 kilometers off our shores, and they just went ahead and said, no, it was an airplane contrail. I mean, they're just saving face because they could not be seen to appear like they don't have everything under control.
That's
because
right.
We're so used to believing that we're a number one.
That's right. That's right.
It's almost endemic of the American psyche. We have to be the best. We have to be number one.
Yeah.
We have to be safe. The American people love that feeling of security. I mean, that's why people have wholeheartedly bought the whole TSA full body scanners, because we have to feel safe, we have to feel secure, and to admit that the Chinese can launch a missile over our skies and say that not only are we not secure, but these people can blow us up at any time.
Well, this whole foreign policy of trying to gain control over the world with our allies in NATO is not only resulting in eroding our economy and killing lots of innocent people, but it's leading to this war at home and a lot on our own civil rights.
It makes us nothing but less safe.
Less safe.
Because we're creating terrorists and enemies everywhere we go. And
we're terrorizing our own population.
And we're terrorizing our own population.
These full-body searches when you get on a plane, which is,
right.
I think, ridiculous.
Well, should we talk about the TSA pat-down law?
Sure.
Very recently in the news, Texas passed a law 138-0 in their House of Representatives to make it a was it a misdemeanor for a for the TSA agents to illegally pat you down, you know, where of the, you know, I'll use the terms in the article, breasts, buttocks, or genitals. it's already, that's illegal. A cop can't do that. An FBI agent can't do that. They can't just run up to you and stick their hand down your pants because they want to or because they think they need to. They have to witness. They have to have probable cause. The Fourth Amendment didn't go anywhere. We still have it. I mean, if you didn't learn it in your high school civics class, learn it. Go read the Bill of Rights because they apply to all of us.
Fourth Amendment. You know, they got this Constitution.
You're supposed to be safe on your papers and persons, in your papers effects. A person, I think that's the word. And
you need probable government should have that probable cause if they can search you.
And no warrant shall be issued without probable cause by and a judge has to read it and approve it.
So the Texans had this bill. The Texas House voted unanimously in favor for it.
Right.
Did it become a law?
No, because it would have convicted the TSA agents could face a $4,000 fine and up to 1 year in jail. And the bill made it to the Texas Senate, and supposedly the assistant governor, what do you call that position? Lieutenant governor, publicly said that he supported the bill, but then privately brought his conversations with the feds to the Senate and said that the TSA was threatening to shut down all flights in and out of Texas. If this bill became a law, and the TSA's response officially said they were quoting the Supremacy Clause, and the Supremacy Clause says that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So they were saying that the states cannot regulate the federal government. Now, if you're just listening to that clause that I just read, you'd be like, okay, you know, I guess that means that the state can't override the laws of the United States. Except there's one nuance there. There is no law that says the TSA agent can stick their hand down their pants. That's just something that they do.
They just do.
And people just take it because they're afraid of people in uniforms. But these people they're not trained. A lot of them are pedophiles with criminal records. They're taking pictures. They're selling them. They're stealing things out of your bags and selling them on eBay. Every week we find an article about this.
It's just theater. It's just theater.
How do we calculate the risk? And, you know, sometimes we don't.
Hello, yes, caller?
What's going on?
We don't calculate it correctly. We either overstate it or understate it.
Dave, are you in the studio?
Yeah, that was Hillary Clinton talking about the TSA.
Thank you very much. I recognize her voice. Yeah, what are the risks? Look at the if you want to know if it's a sham, just consider the fact that only 1/5 of all air cargo is scanned for bombs.
Right,
and
only 2% of passengers are randomly searched. So they said if you take this ability of ours away to randomly stick our hands down your pants with our dirty rubber gloves that we've used to search, you know, 25 other people right before you, it's complete health hazard, then, we're not going to feel safe to fly flights in and out of Texas. But what difference does it make? Because only 2% of people are scanned.
It's not about safety.
It has nothing to do. It's all theater.
It's about keeping up the scare. So we support the war. Did you want to say there, interject there, March?
Well, you know, one thing I love to cite, you know, when it comes to this, I mean, we're you know, terrifying guys hijacking planes and all that and all the rest of it. Folks, look, research, go online, go to Wikipedia and look up Irish Republican Army. For any folks who've ever traveled to Ireland, know the troubles and family from there, these guys were not super terrorists, and they blew up the London Stock Exchange with a bomb made out of fertilizer. You know, I mean, brain surgery. So, and I highly think the TSA aren't checking cars on the highway.
Not yet.
You know, not yet.
I think we're on our way, though. I think we're going to see them at railroad stations.
They've got the Viper vans or something like that, where they drive up and they just have your truck stop at the side of the road, and they X-ray your whole truck with you in it. Yeah, that's nice.
It sounds almost like it's one step away from. I've traveled to Egypt before and seen dictatorships. Folks, you got to be careful. Know your rights, because very rapidly they can disappear.
And if it happens, if one of these bills comes up in your state or here in Connecticut, call your representative because it makes a big difference. If they get 10 calls, if each representative gets 10 calls, that is enough to sway them. Back in Texas, just to complete the story, because that's already old news, the Senate did back down from Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and they pulled the bill. But then because of public pressure, they issued a special session, and they reintroduced the bill
in the Senate.
So there's still a chance that this could get passed in Texas. And Utah, right on the 27th, introduced the same bill. So it's spreading.
And, you know, people have to stand up for their rights, and it's not a Democrat or Republican issue, not liberal or conservative. It's about the ordinary American citizen against the government that's out of control and against the corporate oligarchy that controls our government.
No.
And we gotta fight for our rights, because if we sit on them, they're just going to disappear.
We have to preserve the republic.
So I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our program. I want to thank all of you listeners for joining us. The name of our show is In Context. You're listening to it on WPKN 89.5. FM and Bridgeport, streaming on WPKN.org. We are on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. and on the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe.
I'm Gus Cantavero.
The program is produced by MBR Productions, Inc. We've been joined tonight by our new military affairs commentator March McDermott Rowe. So thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you on the first Sunday in July at 10 p.m.
Have a good night, and God bless the Republic.
Good night.
Good night.